Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome to the first episode of Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. It is raining here in Pasadena. It is a dark night. It's kind of perfect. Listen, I'm so glad you're here. There's a lot of people I want to thank. First person I want to thank is my wife, Susan Lambert. She is the one who suggested the title of the show during a conversation we were having. Without that, this wouldn't be happening. Susan said the words, Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and the idea for the podcast sort of appeared fully formed in my mind. I also want to thank the ASSAP UK, the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, United Kingdom. And finally, of course, and most important, I want to thank Scott and Forrest. I met those guys under some pretty wild circumstances 7 years ago. And we actually met face-to-face for the very first time on March 8th, 2017, which actually would have made a good day to debut the show, but I didn't have my shit together in time, so here we are. But we met at the Raymond restaurant and just a ton of food and lots of sidecars and talked late into the night. And I think from that very first night, we knew something out of the ordinary was happening. I went on their show a couple of times that very first summer, but you know, I gotta say, it didn't take long before I thought of them as friends. I don't know how long it took them to think of. I still don't know if they think of me as a friend. Forrest, I just got his email address like a week ago. But anyway, other than that, I don't have a lot to say. I clearly do have a lot to say. This was supposed to be like two sentences, and here we are, I'm doing a whole extra fucking podcast. But anyway, you all know what you're here for. You kind of know what you're going to get. Maybe you don't. That's all right. We'll figure it out together. So anyway, get ready. Here we go. Ghosts and Specters by Bruce and Nancy Roberts. I grew up on a hillside in Monterey Park, California, just a few miles east of downtown Los Angeles. Sometimes at night, I'd stand on my bed and lean way over and look out my window. From there, I could see the lights of downtown flickering in the distance. To me, those lights were the real world. A world of happy, secure, content people who had jobs they loved and ate in fancy restaurants and didn't feel trapped in their lives and scared all the time. Those people were called grown-ups, and that's what I wanted to be. If I could see that world from my bedroom, that meant I could get there one day and be one of them. Those lights gave me direction and a destination. They gave me hope. Years later, I realized my window faced the wrong way, and I wasn't looking at downtown Los Angeles at all. I was looking at a strip mall, and beyond that, a cemetery. I turned 8 years old on November 2nd, 1974. It was a Saturday, and since my Aunt Sally's birthday was on the 3rd, my mom threw a party for both of us. It was a nighttime party, and it was just after Halloween, so that was the theme. I loved Halloween. And after 3 years of asking for books about ghosts, and then being crushed when people bought me Scooby-Doo or Casper the Friendly Ghost paperbacks, I finally had the foresight to ask for something more specific. I want books about real ghosts. This request left every adult in my life with a look on their face that said, "What the serious fuck is wrong with this kid?" I was about a year away from knowing the word parapsychology. But if I had, I would have used it. I had never even seen a book about real ghosts, but I knew they had to exist in the grown-up world. And I really wanted to live in the grown-up world. It had to be better than the kid world, which was not going well at all. My obsession with ghosts began 3 years earlier, on Halloween, when my kindergarten teacher made us gather on the floor by the record player, where she played the LP of Walt Disney's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Sitting there, listening to the story of Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman, I started having feelings. I felt like I was being stripped naked and that all my friends could suddenly see this thing inside of me that I'd been trying so hard to keep secret. That thing was fear. Of course, they couldn't really see it at five, even I knew that they couldn't. I was already an expert at keeping my fear concealed. But there was something darkly thrilling about that feeling of being totally hidden and completely revealed at the same time. Sometimes, when I was alone in my room, I'd close the drapes and sit on the floor, and I'd think about that feeling. I'd take it out and try it on. After a while, I'd feel my cheeks burning and my hands shaking and my stomach tingling, and it would be too much, and I'd push the feeling away. The process always left me embarrassed and scared, but it also calmed me down. And that brought me to another thing the legend of Sleepy Hollow made me feel: relief. Because it told me that fear also existed outside of me. Other people felt it too. So, in this way, Ichabod Crane's terror at being overcome and annihilated by the Headless Horseman brought me comfort. He and I were the same. And even though in the story he died, the fact that he existed at all and felt my feelings meant that I wasn't alone. You might be thinking I was a scared little kid, and you'd be right. I was afraid all the time. When I was at home, I was afraid of going to school. And when I was at school, I was afraid of going back home. An 8-year-old, or a 7-year-old, or a 6-year-old, or a 5-year-old, can't control the behavior and emotions of every person in their environment, but fuck it if I wasn't going to try. I didn't have a choice. It was about personal survival. My mom was depressed, and she could fly into fits of rage. From before I could speak, I had trained myself to feel when those storms were coming. Trying to control my mom's emotions was a 24-hour job, and every other part of my childhood life was arranged along that terrifying landscape. But no matter how hard I tried to make her happy, sooner or later, her anger would explode. And every time it did, I felt like I was dying. I felt like Ichabod Crane, running for his life from the Headless Horseman, blood flooded with adrenaline and terror. That's who I was at 8. And 7. And 6. And 5. In fact, it's who I'd been since the day I was born. The night of my shared birthday party, I finally hit the gift jackpot, and it was given to me by Aunt Sally herself. It was a book called Ghosts and Specters by Bruce and Nancy Roberts. It was published by Doubleday and Company in 1974. It was a slim hardback, only 93 pages long, and it was illustrated with Bruce Roberts' photography and filled with 10 supernatural stories, all of which were 100% true. I knew this because this was a grown-up book. There were no cartoon illustrations on the cover, or anywhere else, intended to reassure the reader that this book was all in fun. This book wasn't fun. It was a fucking nightmare. And it was real. The very first words of the introduction make that clear. Quote, "Whether you believe in ghosts or not, these stories are true." Those words had the unintended effect of reassuring me. No one in this book was going to tell me that there was nothing to be afraid of, or that there was no such thing as ghosts. This book was going to play it straight with me. And I could handle it. I'd been handling it. What I needed was someone in the outside world telling me I wasn't crazy, and that being afraid was an okay thing to be, and that real grown-ups in the real world felt that way too sometimes. Good. On the cover of the book was what looked like an actual photograph of a ghost pirate. It was blurry and indistinct, only a partial figure, which made it both scary and sad. Someone had died, and a part of them was still trying to reach out and connect and be seen. How awful. How wonderful. I glanced through the book and saw more photographs of ghosts. A glowing fog. That was the Gray Man, a spirit that warned people of sudden hurricanes. A smear of light along the railroad track at twilight? This was the ghost of Joe Baldwin, a signalman who had been decapitated by a locomotive. But that apparently wasn't enough to make him quit his job, so he's still out there swinging that lantern forever, I guess. This ghost shit is real, I thought. It has now been confirmed by grown-ups, and I'm holding the proof in my hands. One thing I would not do at night under any circumstances was walk through my house. I had two very specific nightmare scenarios. The first was me standing alone in the dark in the middle of the family room and suddenly hearing a soft voice speak directly into my left ear.
Richard.
The second was me walking past the hall closet and suddenly seeing the doorknob twisting wildly as something tried to get out. But now I had a new nightmare. Ghosts and specters. During the day, the book was the best thing I owned. It gave me power. But at night, the book became more problematic. I didn't like having it in my room, but leaving it out in the family room made me feel weird, like maybe it was lonely out there. Maybe it was thinking about me just like I was thinking about it. It was that damn ghost pirate on the cover, Captain Flint. During the day, he was on my side, but at night, I just wasn't sure. On the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the whole school day was basically going to be a party. Instead of regular class, we'd spend the morning doing an art project where we'd trace our hands onto a flimsy white paper plate, then color them in to resemble a turkey for some reason. Like most other things in school, this was a task I found both pointless and unachievable. Then for lunch, there'd be a pilgrim feast. And then after that, show and tell. I lived for show and tell. And that day, I brought ghosts and specters. When it was my turn, I stood before the class, my skin burning with emotion and arousal, as I turned the pages and displayed the world of the terrifying unknown to my subhuman classmates whose friendship I craved. Maybe now they would understand that everything they cared about was stupid. Kickball and Hello Kitty backpacks didn't really matter much once you realized we lived in a world where souls lived on after death in a sort of timeless haze, wandering our physical world filled with sadness and longing, desperately wanting to be seen, but not knowing how. I remember returning to my seat as the kids sat there in stunned silence. I figured my teacher would suspend show and tell for the rest of the afternoon, and instead, we'd discuss what had just happened and how we would approach this new world that I had just opened up for them. I'd answer questions. I'd be patient and kind. I knew it was a lot to take in. I'd been there too. But now we had no choice but to support each other. The information I had just shared was so intimate and yet so overwhelming that we were now bound together forever. The boys would see me as a leader, someone to trust and respect as an equal, or slightly more than an equal since I was the one who brought the book to school. And the girls, well, I suspected some of them would mistake this newfound connection for love. Some of them would develop crushes on me. That was okay. It was understandable. And would I take advantage of their vulnerability to me? No, because I could imagine what it must feel like to suddenly have your world opened up and handed back to you like a gift by someone who until today you just thought of as a skinny weirdo. Then later, if a real relationship developed, that was different. Then we would be a couple. But any feelings we would have for each other would pale next to our deeper interest in the occult mysteries that I'd allowed them access to. We all had a long road ahead of us, but at least now, it was a road of wonder and feelings that transcended the fucking boring world of Room 6 at Brightwood Elementary School. Finally, we'd be living a real life filled with real knowledge and education that was worth having, not just memorizing the shapes of the states and learning their capitals. And they all had me to thank for this. But then I realized that no one was thinking about ghosts and specters anymore. They were all looking at Danny Voltava, who was in front of the class showing off the knife his dad had given him. And since it was 1974, everyone was totally cool with him flicking it open and closed and then slicing a peachy folder in half, until finally Miss Crane made him give it to her until after class and told him to go sit down. That afternoon, I sat on the grassy slope in front of the school, waiting for my mom to pick me up. I was alone. It was cloudy and quiet. While I waited, I reread The Gray Man's Warning, the one about the ghost who appears along the coast of South Carolina whenever a hurricane is expected. and it turns out that whoever sees him can expect their house to be spared by the storm. Which is weird because I thought it would be the other way around. If you saw him, then for sure your house would be destroyed. But at least now you had a chance to grab a few things and get the fuck out before nature demolished you and your house. Otherwise, why show up? There's a hurricane coming, but you'll be fine. It's not really much of a warning. By the way, this story is typical of the collection. It has the quality of sounding familiar, even though you've never heard it before. But to an 8-year-old me, it was like reading a newspaper article. I imagine going to South Carolina and following up on these stories. Maybe finding a few of the people they happened to and getting their accounts firsthand. Proof on top of proof. And maybe, just maybe, if I walked along the train tracks at sunset, I'd catch a glimpse of Joe Baldwin's light. Just then, the book was ripped from my hands. I looked up to see Danny holding it and dancing back away from me. Come and get your book! Come and get it! I didn't, of course. I knew how to deal with bullies. You didn't do what they said, and you didn't let them bait you. You just held on and waited it out and hoped a teacher would come by. But somehow they never did. They wouldn't now, that was for sure. School had been over for over 20 minutes. So I just sat there. I watched as Danny took out his knife and flicked out the blade and held the sharp tip against the cover of the book. Danny wasn't alone. Dino Skensos and Paul and Manny Rojas were there too. Paul and Manny were twins, and they scared me. Dino didn't. Dino was a nice kid, funny and short, who I guessed was sort of their mascot. Why he put up with their relentless abuse was a mystery to me. I'd seen Danny and the Rojas twins make other kids cry, but that was one humiliation I didn't have to worry about. I knew to a moral certainty that they would not and could not make me cry. When threatened, I had the ability to go dead inside. I know, it sounds bad, and it felt horrible, but at least on the outside, it didn't show. Danny danced forward and back, pressing the knife point into the book. Come and get it! Paul and Manny and Dino were all watching, smiling awkwardly, waiting for something to happen. And then it did. I'm pretty sure it was an accident. The knife slipped and tore a 4-inch cut down the center of the book cover, right through Captain Flint's ghost body. Danny let out a shocked laugh. Oh, shit, he said. Then, here, and he dropped the book on the ground like it was a foul thing he regretted touching in the first place. He and the other three ran away like they were in trouble, for about 10 feet. Then they slowed down. Then Danny turned back, raised his middle finger at me, and yelled, "Fuck you, you dick." I could hear them laughing as they walked away. I waited until they were out of sight. And then I stood up and walked over and picked up my book. As I did, my mom drove up. I got in the car and she looked at the book and said, "What happened?" I told her I'd dropped it. She could tell I was upset. After a moment, she said, "Well, that's how you learn. Don't take things you care about to school." And that was the last thing she said about it. That night, I sat alone in my room. The book was ruined, not just the cover, the whole book. It was childish and stupid. Fake pictures and stories that made no sense. Is that what my mom meant? Don't share the things you care about with other people because as soon as you do, you'll see in their eyes how foolish you are. Don't show your secret self to anyone because that self is no good. Why give anyone that kind of power over you? Maybe my mom, in her own way, really was trying to look out for me. The fact was that no one at school cared about the things I cared about, and it put me in a terrible position. I couldn't make meaningful connections there. I couldn't care about sports and music and who was more popular than who, but the other kids had strength in their numbers and they all lived in a shared reality. I was the outsider. But instead of just ignoring me, which was bad enough, there seemed to be some kind of real anger directed at me. I didn't understand it, but the fact that I didn't care about the things they cared about made me a threat. It made me a lightning rod for their hostility. I took the cover off my book and crumpled it up and threw it away. Now the book didn't scare me as much, but it didn't interest me as much either. And looking at it didn't give me power anymore. It just made me feel stupid. The last month of 1974 went by quickly. The anticipation of Christmas took over, as it always did for kids back then, and that lifted my spirits. And my mom loved Christmas, so for those weeks, when the house was filled with colored lights and berry-scented candles, and Christmas carols sung by the new Christy minstrels, I was pretty safe. She'd decorate the house and cook and clean all day, pretty much by herself. And on Christmas Eve, we'd host the annual party with all the relatives on her side of the family. Grammy and Grampy, Aunt Carol and Uncle Lou, Aunt Sally and Uncle Bob, and my cousins, Lindy, Gail, Rob, and Jan. It's strange that for such a fraught childhood, my memories of Christmas are all good. That year, as soon as all the cousins arrived, we piled into my brother John's room like we usually did, and my cousin Rob launched into the story of Bloody Mary. His version went like this. If you're brave enough to try it, you go into a darkened room and stand in front of a mirror armed with nothing but a flashlight. You close your eyes and turn three circles chanting, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary. And after the third turn, you open your eyes and turn on the flashlight and shine it straight into the mirror, and you will see the ghost you have invoked, Bloody Mary, her face covered in blood, her forehead split by a hatchet that lodges there still. Rob grinned. Should we try it? I didn't want to. I was way too scared. But for the sake of science, it was decided that we had to do it. Or more accurately, I had to do it. After all, I was the one who was interested in ghosts. It seemed pretty unfair since I was also the youngest of the six of us. Plus, I had kind of backed off the whole ghost thing, but they didn't know that, and there was no way for me to explain it without sounding like a coward. So 5 minutes later, we'd found a flashlight, and I walked into my parents' bedroom all alone and stood in front of my mother's vanity mirror. And I have to tell you, I've never felt such naked fear. When your older cousins come at you with knowledge, you believe it. And I'm here to tell you, I absolutely expected to see the butchered face of Bloody Mary staring back at me in that mirror. And how angry would she be to be called into service by some stupid 8-year-old, and on Christmas Eve, no less? I also have to tell you, it never even occurred to me to just stand there for a minute or so and then walk back out and say that nothing happened. I said I'd do it. Now I had to do it. So I did it. I closed my eyes and said, Bloody Mary, and turned around three times and pointed the flashlight into the mirror and saw nothing but a bright light shining back at me. The relief I felt was huge. I had endured something terrifying and survived. This is what skydiving must feel like. I was high on adrenaline for the rest of the night. It wasn't until later that the roof fell in. My cousin Jan and I were digging through my backpack, looking for the lyric sheet from my school Christmas show so we could convince the other kids to go caroling with us before the parents said it was too late, and we all had to get home and go to sleep so Santa can come. Jammed way down at the bottom of my backpack was a crumpled piece of lined notebook paper. My letter to Santa. One of the last assignments we'd had before the 2-week holiday was writing our wish list that we'd then take home and have our parents help us mail. And I'd completely forgotten. The math was clear and unforgiving. No letter to Santa, no gifts on Christmas morning. A tidal wave of self-loathing washed over me. I wasn't going to get any presents in the morning, and the worst part of it all was that I didn't deserve to get any. I was spiraling. In the middle of the happiest night of the year, I had managed to ruin everything. I felt terrible, almost bad enough to cry. Gail walked in, and Jan told her what I'd done. Gail was 6 years older than me, and she took charge of the situation immediately. Let me see that list. Jan handed it to her, and Gail looked it over calmly before handing it back to me. Do you know which stocking is yours? I nodded, feeling better already since Gail seemed so unfazed by this obvious disaster. Here's what you do, she said. Take the list and put it in your stocking. When Santa comes, he'll find it and give you everything you asked for. Really? This was possible? I'd never heard about this loophole. I had no problem believing that a mythical being was going to appear in my house that night. But how was he supposed to have all the stuff I wanted? He hadn't had any time to go shopping. Gail reassured me. This happens all the time, she said. Don't worry. Santa knows you. It'll work. Like I said, when an older cousin drops knowledge on you, you believe it. And I did. So I put the list in my stocking and went to bed. And the next morning, when I rushed into the living room, I discovered that my cousin Gail had, as usual, been absolutely right. Depression set in right on schedule when it was time to go back to school. But this time it was different. It was a creeping numbness, an absence of joy or fear or anger or really any emotion at all. I moved through my life as an observer more than a participant, a disinterested observer. At school I was, as usual, no one to anyone. But now, more and more, I felt like I was no one to myself. The person I had been, the one who was interested in ghosts, was gone now, and no one new had come to take his place. I felt empty. Maybe this is how adults actually felt. Maybe this was growing up. And if my hope was that things would get better, maybe I was in for a huge disappointment. When the third graders were assigned to go to the library in pairs and read to the first graders, I did it, but with no great excitement. I had a strong dislike for children younger than me. I could barely stand the ones my own age. Mrs. Fuller, the librarian, looked like Betty White from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and I eventually liked her. But she came on a little too strong at first and acted like we'd somehow known each other for years, which I found off-putting. She also seemed to like me more than the other third graders, and that made me not trust her. But after a few weeks, I got used to it and decided there was no looming threat here. Maybe Miss Crane had told her I liked books, and for a librarian, that put me on the good list? My library partner was Evelyn Lee, and since we walked together from room 6 to the library every Thursday afternoon for reading group, I decided I had a crush on her. By the fifth week of reading group, my crush had developed into a churning, pounding obsession. She didn't know about it, but for me, the world was suddenly filled with color and light. I couldn't have put it into words, but I realize now I was happy to be feeling something. I wanted to feel something, and feeling this felt good, so I did. The library became a romantic destination. I found I could make Evelyn laugh whenever I wanted to, and this filled me with a rush of pleasure and power. I thought about her all the time. Valentine's Day was on a Thursday that year, so I decided I would give her my Valentine on our walk back from reading group, because that was our special place. It was just a pre-printed card, but I was pretty sure she felt the same way I did, so this simple acknowledgement of our mutual love would be enough to cement our relationship. But as it turned out, there was no walk to the library that day. Reading group was canceled so that each class could have a Valentine's Day party in their homeroom. The party in room 6 worked like this. You sat at your desk, and the teacher and her assistant gave each child 2 heart-shaped cookies, a Dixie cup of Hawaiian punch, and a small baggie of those chalky little candy hearts that said things like, "First kiss and be mine." We weren't allowed to pass out personal Valentines at school because too many people's feelings got hurt. But that didn't stop kids from doing it anyway because so many people liked someone. I sat across the room from Evelyn, and none of us were allowed to leave our seats while the party was occurring, so I was stuck. As we all sat there like a pack of obedient dogs waiting for permission to start eating, I saw Gary Popovich reach into his desk and hand something red to Evelyn. She took it and smiled at him like she'd been expecting just this. And then she handed something red back to him. This was all done with a level of calm assurance and mutual expectation that eviscerated me. They were already boyfriend and girlfriend. They had been the whole time, and I had no idea. And so, like an idiot, I had let myself imagine a relationship where there was none. How could I have not seen it? And all those feelings I was feeling, they were meaningless, pointless. They were nothing. I was nothing. Evelyn and Gary were real people. They saw each other. No one saw me. I was invisible. A few weeks later, on a rainy Sunday afternoon, I had the first attack. It came while I was watching television. It was a Marx Brothers movie called Horse Feathers. Google it, kids. This was my favorite one, but somewhere in the middle of it, my attention drifted, and suddenly I found myself feeling a despair like nothing I'd ever known. One minute I was happy, and the next I was swallowed by the crushing reality that life was meaningless and ended irrevocably in death. I had no idea where this feeling was coming from, but it consumed me. It destroyed me. And I found that I wanted to cry. I really, really wanted to cry because at least then my mom would see something was wrong and take care of me. But I couldn't even cry. This was terrifying. Do grown-ups get this feeling? Does my mom? Does everyone? I couldn't understand what was happening. I thought I might actually be dying. I focused as hard as I could on the television. I watched the rest of Horse Feathers, blank-faced and unmoving. And by the time it was over, the horrible feeling had eased up enough for me to go back to my normal state of hiding my feelings and pretending to be okay. I still had to walk to reading group with Evelyn every Thursday, but now it was no fun for me at least. I hated her for liking Gary Popovich instead of me, and I wanted her to know that. But expressing negative feelings was dangerous. It was something I wasn't allowed to do. So instead, I found it way easier to push those feelings down and just act the same way I'd always acted around her and pretend to be her friend, while in truth, I knew she was my enemy. And of course, she'd never know the difference. "Are you mad at me?" she asked me this later as we were about to leave reading group. "No," I said, and acted surprised, because I was surprised. How could she know my real feelings? Could she see through me? Could she see me? Then she said, "You've been acting mad since Valentine's Day." She looked down and said, "I don't like Gary, so don't be mad at me for that." It was like a crippling pain I'd been feeling for weeks was instantly lifted. But at the same time, what the fuck was going on? How could she know how I felt? And how could she not like Gary when I knew she did? Or I thought she did. I was getting confused. My anger was draining out of me, but before it vanished, I used the last of it to ask, "So who do you like?" She looked at me and said, as if it was the most obvious thing in the world, "I don't like anyone." My head was spinning. She had to like someone. We all liked someone. It was third grade. But something in her face and her voice made it very clear she was speaking the absolute truth. So I hadn't hid my feelings from her, and I had totally misread all of her feelings. This was very bad news for me, because controlling feelings was how I controlled my life and everyone in it. I didn't understand what was happening, and I didn't like it. The bell rang. It was time to go. Mrs. Fuller came up to us, but instead of thanking us and saying goodbye like she always did, she turned to Evelyn and said, "You go on back to class, sweetie. I need Richard's help on a special project. Just tell Miss Crane I said it was okay." Evelyn just nodded and turned and left. I had no idea what was going on. Was I in trouble? I didn't think so. I was extremely good at knowing when grown-ups were mad. Or I thought I was. Mrs. Fuller stood up straight and looked down at me and said, "Miss Crane tells me you're interested in ghosts." I had a quick flash of embarrassment. I hadn't talked about ghosts in months. I hadn't even talked about the Bloody Mary thing, and that was the best story I had. It was the bravest thing I'd ever done. I had worked really hard to make people forget about ghosts and specters, but I guess that hadn't worked either. There was no one else around. And something in her tone so clearly took me and that interest seriously that I got over myself and just said, "Yes." She said, "Follow me." So I did. We left the brightly carpeted reading group area and went through a door that contained a sort of an airlock between the children's library and wherever it was we were going. She opened the second door, and we were released into a giant space easily five times the size of the room we'd just been in. I looked around. It was large and bright and silent and filled with books. Only books. There were no colorful posters with frogs on lily pads saying, "Reading is cool." or any other thing to try to cajole you into giving books a try. This place didn't care if you liked reading or not. If you did, fine. If you didn't, get the fuck out. I was impressed. I'd heard about this place, but the kids in my grade weren't allowed in here. And neither were the kids in fourth or fifth or even sixth grade. This place was strictly for grades 7 and 8. This was a place for teenagers. This was the middle school library. Mrs. Fuller kept walking deeper into the room. I followed her past what must have been hundreds of books. The air was dry and smelled like paper and dust. We turned down a long cul-de-sac where the shelves stretched higher than any kid my age could reach without a chair. "I think this'll be right up your alley," she said. I'd never heard that phrase, and I didn't completely understand it. This tunnel of books did feel like an alley, alluring and dangerous. Maybe that's what she meant. Finally, we stopped, and she tapped a long acrylic nail against a printed label affixed to the shelf just above my eye level. It was a word I'd never seen. Paranormal. When my eyes didn't flare with understanding, she could tell I'd never heard the word before. "These are all the books about ghosts and flying saucers and monsters and ESP, you know, things like that." Now my eyes did flare. It wasn't just one or two books. It was an entire shelf. She smiled at me and then at the books. "Paranormal means all the stuff we don't understand yet. You're allowed to come in here and check out these books anytime you like." I stood there gazing at those books and their mysterious spines and titles, and I knew that I'd found my place. And over time, I'd end up reading almost all of them. Some were weird. Some were boring. Some were wonderful. Some truly were above my grade level. Some I stole and still have in my home to this day. Some gave me that feeling of power I remembered from Ghosts and Specters. But what Mrs. Fuller really gave me that day, when she introduced me to my first paranormal bookshelf, was the permission and space to search for myself and to try to sort out all the stuff I didn't understand yet. I had so much of that. It was time to get started. Thank you for joining me here on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music is by Nima Kazaruni. Next time, join me for one of the strangest love stories of all time. That's right, Richard Haddam and Susan Lambert. Oh, but also a man named David Huggins and a woman named Crescent who, let's just say, doesn't live in the neighborhood. We're going to dive into love in an alien purgatory. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.